Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith, featuring the March 2024 Opera with Opera News magazine. We'll begin by continuing the section, Opera on DVD and Blu-ray. Reuter's Sox is key to the staging, strong in baritonal depth and magnetically watchable. Whether in the elegiac Fleeter monologue, lovingly addressed to his Jack Daniels, the intricate negotiations with Walter and Beckmesser, or his slowly evolving mental processes during the Act III prelude, Curtain Now Up, and Vaughn monologue. If there is a whiskey-sour kicker at the end, when we find him leading a populist revolution, Reuter harnesses all Sox's maverick charisma, and our response to his interpretation may well condition our verdict on Berlin's bold, genial, and musically captivating production. By Christopher Weber. L'Incoronazione di Papea, Monteverdi. Chateau de Versailles Spectacle. CVS 118, 164 minutes. Ted Hoffman's take on Monteverdi's final opera was first seen at the X Festival in 2022, receiving a glowing review in these pages. Later taken up by Valencia and Versailles, the production was shortlisted for an International Opera Award in 2022. This performance, filmed at the Opéra Royal at Versailles in January 2023, features a substantially different cast to that seen at X, though Jay Carditi's Nerone and Alex Rosen's impressive Seneca remain. Huffman's production includes several features that, according to his opera interview, are something of a trademark. So we have the sparse setting, with a kind of stage within a stage at the back, in which the characters, not performing, spend much of their time. Otherwise, they can be found near the costume rails at the side of the stage, a conceit that allows characters needing to change to do so without leaving the stage. In one sense, that is effective, emphasizing the claustrophobic ambiance that is undoubtedly a part of the opera. Apt, too, is the manner in which Amore plays puppet master with characters, reminding us that the entire opera is driven by love or desire. The long piece of piping suspended above the stage mystifies me as much as it did our ex-reviewer. Costumes are modern, with some odd outfits such as the pink short trousers worn by Yestin Davies Atone. The production has received sufficient praise for an alternative view that stems from both musical and staging reservations. In short, the performance is long on sensuality and lust, short on style. There is, in fact, plentiful evidence that Hoffman has no interest in historical accuracy. The most egregious example allows the banished Ottavia to be manhandled in the course of the great Addio Roma, therefore ignoring the precept that the 17th century lament was an undisturbed moment. Nearly as questionable is the distasteful defiling of Seneca's body after his death, which may have happened in Nero's Rome, but certainly did not in 17th century Venetian opera houses. Style is wanting musically too, though this is considerably better than the Papea à l'Arçon conducted at the Ambrone Festival some years ago. He now uses more appropriate forces, with a pair of violins and bass, though the cornetto and recorder are superfluous. The continuo group is, as is so often the case, too fleshed out with plucked instruments, who at times produce some weird and not-so-wonderful effects. Alarcon's direction, especially in the extensive passages of Recitar Cantando, is often too measured, encouraging singers who appear in most cases to have little experience of the style to sing too lyrically. This applies to both Elsa Benowitz's Papea and Jay Carditi's Nerone, both in their way excellent and compulsive in their lust for one another. Benowitz as alluring and dangerous a Papea as one could wish for. Its star of the performance is, however, Ambrosine Bray, whose Ottavia is quite simply magnificent, a performance sung with a spellbinding passion and vocally acted with a sense of style unique to the performance. Disprezzata Regina, her Act I Scena, is delivered with a kaleidoscopic variety of color and mood, as Ottavia moves from wretchedness to the fury of a woman scorned, displaying at times a truly imposing chest register. Although not quite on that level, the Drusilla of the young Indian-American soprano Maya Karani also impresses, her love for Davies' over-lyrical Ottone touchingly conveyed, her nobility and adversity well conveyed. Julie Rosette's Amore is well-characterized but overplayed at times, while Stuart Jackson fills the travesti roles of the servant Arnalta and Nutrice with aplomb. Ornamentation is haphazardly and often unstylishly applied, suggesting little time was devoted to it in rehearsal. Bray's unforgettable and supremely rounded Ottavia gives this Poppea its one claim to any real distinction. For that above all, I will return to this performance, a Poppea of the 21st rather than the 17th century, by Brian Robbins. Amal and the Night Visitors, Minotti. Naxos DVD 2.110763. Blu-ray NDB 0175V. 55 minutes. Though the popularity of Minotti's sweet tale of the crippled shepherd boy visited by the three kings on their way to Bethlehem has waned over the years, Amal and the Night Visitors still enjoys many American productions. European ones are rarer, and Music Theater an der Wien's December 2022 revival offers the unexpected lure of a staging by the auteur director Stefan Herheim. The result is as bold, controversial, and theatrically savvy as his admirers could have wished, though goodness knows what the composer would have thought of it. By making Amal a terminally ill child, enduring his last night on earth, Herheim layers Minotti's 1951 sentimentalities with a modern sensibility, tricking out the set with a hospital bed and hecatombs of soft stuffed toys. Amal's distraught mother is supported by a doctor, nurse, and cleric, who serve as dance doubles for the kings, traditional figures in biblical garb, straight off a Christmas card. Are they real or a fevered vision? In place of the rustic shepherd's chorus, we have bereaved parents reunited with her dead children, winged angels filing down a Hansel and Gretel staircase. Amal himself is cured, not by Christian miracle, but by death, winning his wings and mounting the stairs to visit baby Jesus in heaven. But importantly, Herheim allows us to sense the original scenario underlying his own, giving us space to resist the tear-jerking manipulations of both. The principals inhabit their reframed roles naturally, with Tempu Ishijima's clear-voiced, direct, and engaging Amal leading the way. His enunciation of Kurt Hanolka's unfussy German text, which I preferred to the composer's stilted English, is perfect, and his acting adds spice to Minotti's sugar. His mother, stealing the king's gold in a last-ditch attempt to save her son, is movingly portrayed by Jadmilja Kaiser. The ambiguous final image, mixing exhausted sadness with relief that her trial is over, lingers in the mind. The three kings and their doubles are good, too. I was especially taken with Nikolai Borchov's lyric baritone Melchior and the Arnold Schoenberg Chor and Wiener Symphoniker under Magnus Lodgaard do full justice to Amal's filmic scoring. This Naxos release, sonically and visually outstanding on Blu-ray, is not perhaps one for traditionalists. I can only say that Herheim's shamelessly modern take on a 70-year-old Christmas sweetmeat seemed to me to reinvigorate Amal, scenically and dramatically, while still inviting us to enjoy Minotti's score for its frank melodic simplicities. by Christopher Weber. Wanda by Winook Nazarova. There is a special joy in the discovery of a new opera of quite exceptional quality, and a sadness at the realization that it was written by a 74-year-old composer of manifestly outstanding gifts who remains unknown outside her home country. The work is Wanda, the composer Joanna Winook Nazarova. In Poland, she is associated with Penderecki. She was his outstanding composition pupil, Lutosławski, and Górecki, and is celebrated for a varied career that, in addition to composing, has included politics as Minister of Culture and Art, teaching, and directorships of leading Polish orchestras. Only since her retirement in 2018 has she been able to devote substantial time to composition, one of the fruits of which is this, her first opera. Its libretto is drawn from a mystery play by Cyprian Kamil Norwid, a leading Polish romantic poet who is closely connected to Chopin. He had to reinvent the play after its loss in the insurrection of 1848. Its story derives from a primordial Polish tale about a woman called Wanda, who was democratically elected to be king, and who, in order to save her country and its culture, drowned herself in the Vistula rather than marry her German lover, the chieftain Rüdiger. It is, Winook Nazarova insists, a story about beautiful but also unfulfilled love, about obligation and liability, about choices that define our life and death, with characters that are utterly realistic. Wanda's is a tragic dilemma. She fears that marriage to a leader of a nation more powerful than hers would have disastrous consequences, so she sacrifices herself for the common good. Structured in 6 scenes, the opera's opulently layered contemporary score includes 4 sharply characterized principal roles, 2 choirs, one of them a children's choir, dancers, and a large orchestra. Yet it runs for barely more than an hour, the result of a compositional style whose deft use of extreme compression enables it to accomplish its purposes quickly and with remarkable precision. Though the writing is atonal, in parts even dodecaphonic, Winook Nazarova doesn't regard her score as avant-garde, nor, apart from hints of Polish dance rhythms, Krakowienne, Kijowiak, Polonaise, are there stylistic imitations of Polish music. A compelling dramatic sensibility is paramount, and is strikingly evident in the way the powerful, percussive opening ostinato transmutes into a seemingly ineluctable, sometimes dirge-like tug towards the inevitable. A tragic climax as astonishing dramatically as it is sonically. Wonderfully, the music has a captivating sense of line across its modernist complexities, making it immediate, attractive, and accessible. The disc is a superb filmic record of the 2021 premiere in the beautiful arcaded courtyard of the Wawel Royal Castle in Krakow, an event that formed part of the celebrations for the bicentenary of Norwid's birth. There are no sets to speak of. Changes of lighting and costumes, which are attractive and significant, suffice. With orchestra and cast on almost the same level, cameras that move freely around the stage and auditorium in many close-ups, the film admirably conveys intimacy and a sense of the production as a collective achievement. Agata Schmidt uses her sumptuously hued mezzo to excellent effect as Wanda. Paula Maciulek is superb as her maid, her beautifully textured, agile soprano among the highlights. His ringing tenor in superb form, Andrzej Lampard brings to the role of Rüdiger a fine sense of lyricism and passion. The eminent Wagnerian bass baritone Tomasz Konieczny, robust and full of portent, is the castellan. The choirs excel, and the aggressively choreographed dancers are riveting warriors. From the podium, Michael Klauza directs with clarity and conviction. The accompanying documentary is a welcome bonus. A splendid hour-long film packed with fascinating and relevant detail, much of it provided by the exceptionally lively and articulate composer, who is interviewed as she moves around town and country, sits at the keyboard, observes rehearsals, reminiscences about Penderecki, and much else. One hopes this outstanding release will bring Nook Nazarova and her opera to wide attention. By Christopher Ballantine. And now opera on CD. Il Ritorno du Lycée in Patria, Monteverdi. Gemelli Factory, GEFA006, 3 CDs. The last recording of Monteverdi's penultimate opera to be reviewed in these pages was accorded the honor of being named Disc of the Month, September 2022. Conducted by Stefan Fugger, it was remarkable for the thought and attention that had gone into the way in which review, recitar cantando, the process of recitation through song, that was the chief component of mid-17th century Italian opera. For me, Fugger's achievement marked a significant step forward in the understanding of Monteverdi's work, and I ended the review wondering whether it might perhaps create a new benchmark. A year on, and such thoughts are still with me, as they are tested for the first time by another DOTM winner, Emiliano González Toro, whose Monteverdi Orfeo was accorded that honor nearly 2 years earlier, December 2020. The question as to whether there is a challenge to that benchmark is easily answered. It isn't, for two critical reasons. The first is that although González Toro acknowledges that the standard instrumentation for Venetian operas of this period was a pair of violins, bass, and modest continuo, he has decided to employ an orchestra of 30 players. But it is not just size, but the manner in which he uses this band, consistently allowing it to mask the all-important vocal line. There are countless examples throughout the performance, but to hear one particularly damaging, one goes to the beautiful passage in the duologue between Minerva and Ulysse, newly arrived on the shore of Ithaca, Act 1, Scene 7. Minerva's Ben Lugamente is here wrecked by Cornetti, who not only mask the text, but play over it, obscuring the words. The second bizarre decision made by González Toro, in my view, is the employment for his Penelope of a young mezzo inexperienced in Baroque opera. Rehab Chaib has a richly toned voice that sounds lovely in Richard Strauss. Try YouTube for an Ariadne extract. But that is of little use in the role of Penelope, much of which lies in a tessitura that ill suits Chaib. A still bigger liability is her inability to express the text in a meaningful way, though González Toro's direction does display a fine appreciation of tactus, thus allowing his singers the necessary flexibility within the beat. The failure of Chaib's Penelope is not in any sense the fault of the singer, but you cannot just step into the part without some kind of understanding of the style. It needs only a couple of minutes' comparison with Lucille Richardot's magnificent assumption of the role for Fugger to appreciate just how far short this falls. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the most satisfying singing comes from González Toro, whose Ulysse is as satisfying as his Orfeo. The scene on the shores of Ithaca mentioned above opens with a long monologue in which the great warrior lies on the beach, questioning his whereabouts and what has happened to him. As he turns events over in his mind, the tension constantly rises and falls. The delivery slackens, then again tightens. González Toro's outstanding vocal acting and variation of both vocal and musical nuance is a masterful lesson that Fugger's characterful Valerio Contaldo cannot quite match. The casting of the remainder of the roles is remarkably generous, with very little duplication and a total of 17 singers used. They include such familiar names as Emok Barat as a bright, lively Minerva, Philippe Jaruski in the small role of Lumana Fragilita, and the characterful bass Fulvio Bettini as the greedy parasite Iro. All the singers involved display, at the very least, capability and often more, though more character might have emerged had Gonzalez Toro not decided that Monteverdi's music needs no additional ornamentation. The presentation is positively luxurious. The sizable book that houses the discs, including no fewer than 5 lengthy articles, all in English, all of which seem determined to put Il Ritorno into the context of Commedia dell'arte. It's one more facet of the set that is, to say the least, odd. Such peculiarities add up to an intriguing, at times rewarding, but ultimately deeply flawed release. By Brian Robbins. Dido and Aeneas, Purcell. Pentatone, PTC, 5187032, 1 CD. It is unfortunate that Holst's description of Dido and Aeneas as the only perfect English opera was used to head Lindsay Kemp's notes for this CD. It immediately tempts the riposte that even were this true, and it isn't, then why has David Bates seen fit to improve the opera with a gratuitous addition of oboes, recorders, and percussion, plus a continuo group that includes 3 theorbos, harp, and organ, used to accompany Aeneas? In an interview with Kemp, also published in the booklet, Bates attempts to justify such additions by returning to the probable court, rather than school, origination of the opera. Noting the likely employment of Italian and French musicians at court, he explains that his large continuo group has its precedence in Italy. But he omits to add that such richly constituted continuo groups were over 50 years out of date by the time of Dido, as was the use of specific instruments to accompany particular roles. It must be admitted that, bar some tastelessly succulent arpeggiations, in practice, these refinements are orally not as damaging as might have been expected. But they are unnecessary, and taken with other irritants, detract from the performance. These include a general tendency by soloists to ignore specified ornaments. Bates's preference for smooth, unarticulated cantabile lines, e.g. the adagio opening of the overture, and some extraordinarily mannered interpretation, e.g., in our deep vaulted cell. And why repeat the final chorus, not asked for by Purcell, at the expense of the Cupid's Dance, here omitted, which provides a beautifully judged conclusion to the opera? So far, sadly, so negative. But mention of the chorus allows for more positive observations, since it is outstanding, singing with excellent diction and articulation, in addition to being finely balanced. None of the solo singing can be dismissed, though it does give the impression of being outside the usual range of some of the singers, as the above comments on ornamentation suggest. The mezzo Fleur Baron concludes a decent assumption of the role of Dido, with a touching, if not heart-rending, account of When I Am Laid in Earth, though she misses the rhetorical element of the second half. Her final exchange with Aeneas in Act 3 also conveys little of the scorn or anger the most successful interpreters achieve. By the same terms, Matthew Brooks's Aeneas fails to avoid the trap of tepid anonymity inherently lurking in the role. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.